morning. It's Tuesday, May 30th, 2006, and this is the KBOO Morning News. I'm Brian Smith.
And I'm Becca Bartleson.
Coming up on this morning's news program, Oregon is preparing for changes to the state welfare system coming in October. The Pentagon is pressing Congress to approve development of a new rapid strike weapon, and the military says brake failure caused a military truck to crash in Afghanistan that killed Afghan civilians. Weather for today calls for mostly sunshine with highs in the mid-70s.
According to the Oregonian, Oregon faces a major and potentially expensive overhaul of its program providing cash to needy families. Currently, about 16% of adults receiving monthly welfare checks have jobs. But on October 1st, new federal rules will require 50% of the adults on welfare to either have a job or participate in an approved program that prepares them to work. Oregon officials say they won't know the full consequences of the change until the federal government releases more information at the end of June. But they concede that the state will have a difficult time meeting the 50% threshold. The state's choices include declaring some families ineligible for state-federal cash assistance, making it more difficult for people to qualify for help, and/or spending more tax money to keep more working Oregonians in the program. That means the man who is elected governor this fall will play a pivotal role in determining the future of the state's welfare program.
The state of Oregon is trying to get a better idea of what kinds of herbicides and insecticides its residents are using to kill off those pesky summer invaders. But be they dandelions, slugs, aphids, or clover. A random sampling of Oregonians will be getting a phone call from the state about such products and be asked to keep a diary to list all the chemicals they used and why. It's part of the state's comprehensive pesticide use reporting system, which was funded by the 2005 legislature after being stalled for years because of budget cuts. The system will track commercial pesticide use through an online database starting in January of 2007. It will catalog what killing chemicals are used by farmers, tree growers, pest exterminators, government agencies, and schools, and even veterinarians. But plenty of pesticides, from mosquito repellent to Roundup, are sold over-the-counter for non-commercial use, hence the random surveys of residents. Among the questions that may be answered, do homeowners use too much? Each quarter, 435 people from across the state are chosen at random and asked to track their usage. The state hopes to get 250 completed and valid surveys out of those. The identities of the chemical users will remain confidential.
The Constitution Party of Oregon has recruited a mystery candidate for governor who promises to make things uncomfortable for Republican nominee Ron Saxton by raising abortion as a central campaign theme. This from the Salem Statesman Journal. Bog Ekstrand, the state chairman of the Conservative Christian Party, said that the governor's race gives the six-year-old party an avenue to broaden its electoral base because of Saxton's support for abortion rights. The Constitution Party platform stresses opposition to abortion rights, limited government, and an official role for religion in public life. The party, along with other minor parties that have secured automatic places on Oregon ballots, has until August 29th to select its candidates for the general election in November. Party activists will select their governor candidates Saturday at a nominating convention in Lake Oswego. The party expects to divulge the candidate's name 3 days before the convention.
The Army has launched an investigation into an AWOL soldier's charges that he was misled by a Salem-based recruiter. Captain Brian Peterson said his investigation was prompted by media reports in which Jeremy Crawford said he was lied to by a recruiter. The Army representative allegedly told him that the Army would supply him with medication for anxiety and depression. Crawford said that Sergeant Rennie Lutz, based at the Salem Army South Salem Recruiting Station, assured him that he would receive psychiatric medication at basic training. Crawford also said Lutz advised him not to disclose his medical history during a pre-enlistment physical exam, and that Lutz suggested he stop taking his medication before the exam so that would not be detected by blood testing. After Crawford enlisted, military personnel told him that they were not allowed to dispense mood-stabilizing drugs. Crawford said he fled basic training April 8th because he felt as if he were losing his mind. Crawford told the Salem Statesman Journal that he welcomed the Army investigation. And under Army procedures, Crawford's history of depression and anxiety should have disqualified him from service.
Times reports that the Pentagon is pressing Congress to approve the development of a new weapon that would enable the United States to carry out non-nuclear missile strikes against distant targets within an hour. The proposal has set off a complex debate about whether this program for strengthening the military's conventional capacity could increase the risk of accidental nuclear confrontation. Senator Jack Reed, a member of the Armed Services Committee, said there is great concern that this could be destabilizing in terms of deterrence and nuclear policy. It would be hard to determine if a missile coming out of Trident submarine is conventional or nuclear. General James Cartwright, the chief of the United States Strategic Command, said the system would enhance the Pentagon's ability to preempt conventionally and precisely while limiting the collateral damage. The program would cost an estimated $500 million over 5 years, and the Pentagon is seeking $127 million in its current spending requests to Congress to begin work. But the plan has run into resistance from lawmakers who are concerned that it may increase the risk of an accidental nuclear confrontation. The Trident II missile that would be used for the attacks is a system that has long been equipped with a nuclear payload. Indeed, both non-nuclear and nuclear-tipped variants of the Trident II missile would be loaded on the same submarines under the Pentagon plan.
Cameraman Paul Douglas had spent more than a decade covering the world's hotspots for CBS News. Freelance soundman James Brolin was part of a CBS team honored for its dispatches on the earthquake in Pakistan. Correspondent Kimberly Dozier had reported on the deteriorating situation in Iraq for nearly 3 years. The two British men were killed yesterday in Baghdad when a car bomb exploded as they were working on a story about American troops in Iraq on Memorial Day. Douglas and Brolin died at the scene. The U.S. military said an American soldier and an Iraqi interpreter were also killed in the same blast, and 6 American soldiers were injured. Dozier was in critical condition at a U.S. military hospital in Baghdad and underwent 2 surgeries from injuries from the bomb. CBS News reported on its website that the 3 journalists were embedded with the infantry division when a nearby car packed with explosives detonated. All 3 journalists were believed to have been wearing protective gear at the time.
Federal authorities are actively investigating dozens of American television stations for broadcasting items produced by the Bush administration and major corporations, and passing them off as normal news. Some of the fake news segments talked up success in the war in Iraq or promoted the company's products. Investigators from the Federal Communications Commission are seeking information about stations across the country after a report produced by a campaign group detailed the extraordinary extent of the use of such items. The report, by the nonprofit group Center for Media and Democracy, found that over a 10-month period, at least 77 stations were making use of the Fox News broadcasts, known as video news releases. Not one told the viewers who had produced the items. Diana Farsetta, one of the group's researchers, said the public relations companies commissioned to produce these segments by corporations had become increasingly sophisticated in their techniques in order to get the VNR's broadcast. She said, They have gotten very good at mimicking what a real independently produced television report would look like. The FCC has declined to comment on the investigation, but investigators from the commission's enforcement unit recently approached Ms. Farsetta for a copy of her group's report. The range of VNR is wide. Among items produced by the Bush administration to news station was one in which an Iraqi American in Kansas City was seen saying, "Thank you, Bush. Thank you, USA," in response to the 2003 fall of Baghdad. The footage was actually produced by the State Department, one of 20 federal agencies that have produced and distributed such items.
Former White House and Justice Department officials are saying that the office of Vice President Dick Cheney routinely reviews pieces of legislation before they reach the president's desk, searching for provisions that Cheney believes would infringe on presidential power. This according to the Boston Globe. The official said Cheney's legal advisor and chief of staff, David Addington, is the Bush administration's leading architect of the signing statements, which the president has used on more than 750 laws. The statement asserts the president's right to ignore the law because they conflict with his interpretation of the Constitution. The Bush-Cheney administration has used such statements to claim for itself the option of bypassing a ban on torture, oversight provisions in the USA Patriot Act, and numerous requirements that they provide certain information to Congress. Previous vice presidents have had neither the authority nor the interest in reviewing legislation. But Cheney has used his power over the administration's legal team to promote an expansive theory of presidential authority. Using signing statements, the administration has challenged more laws than all previous administrations combined. According to another former lawyer in the Bush administration, other White House and Justice Department lawyers began vetting legislation with Addington's and Cheney's views in mind, knowing that Addington was likely to review the bills. All these lawyers were extremely careful to flag any provisions that place limits on presidential power. Cheney and Addington have a long history. Addington was a Republican staff member on the Congressional Committee investigating the Iran-Contra scandal in the 1980s, while Cheney was the ranking GOP House member. When Cheney became Defense Secretary under President George H.W. Bush, he hired Addington as a Pentagon counsel.
After more than 30 years in politics, Defense Secretary William Cohen was saddled with credit card debt. Cohen was never wealthy, and his government salary only went so far. When the motorcades and military escorts ended in January 2001, his final financial disclosure form listed of tens of thousands of dollars of charge account debts at an interest rates as high as about 25%. Within weeks of leaving office, he was living in a $3.5 million McLean mansion with a swimming pool, a cabana, and a carriage house. Cohen's career had entered a classic final phase, the monetizing of the public man. During his legislative career, Cohen stood for the purity of the political process, according to the Almanac of American Politics. He made his name as a young Republican, voting to impeach President Richard Nixon over Watergate, and he has said in an interview, passed up lucrative options to stay in public life. He sponsored lobbying reforms. Now his firm promotes itself by touting its connections. The website for a Cohen investment advisory service said until recently, "We specialize in access, insight, and intelligence into the defense industry, DOD, and government programs." The website said the Cohen's Group's competitive advantage included senior-level relationships throughout industry and government.
And the U.S. military is bracing for a major scandal over the alleged murder of Iraqi civilians by Marines in Haditha. The charges so serious they could threaten Bush's effort to rally support at home for an increasingly unpopular war. And while the case has attracted little attention so far in Iraq, it still could inflame hostility to the U.S. presence just as Iraq's new government is getting established, and complicate efforts by moderate Sunni Arab leaders to reach out to their community. U.S. lawmakers have been told the criminal investigations will be finished in about 30 days, but a Pentagon official said investigators believe Marines committed unprovoked murder in the deaths of about two dozen people at Haditha in November. With the political storm brewing, the top U.S. Marine, General Michael Hagee, is headed to Iraq to personally deliver the message that troops should use deadly force only when justified, proportional, and, most importantly, lawful. Haditha is not the only case pending. Last Wednesday, the military announced an investigation into allegations that Marines killed a civilian April 26 near Fallujah. The statement gave no further details except that several service members had been sent back to the United States pending the results of the criminal investigation. Last July, Iraq's ambassador to the United Nations, Samir al-Sumandi, accused the Marines of killing his 21-year-old cousin in cold blood during a search of his family's home in Haditha. Together, the cases present the most serious challenge to the U.S. handling of the Iraq war since the Abu Ghraib prison scandal.
Here's another reason to worry about global warming: more and itchier poison ivy. The noxious vine grows faster and bigger as carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere rise. And a CO2-driven vine also produces more of its rash-causing chemical, urushiol. Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, a chemical that traps heat similar to the way a greenhouse does, thus considered a major contributor to global warming. Greenhouse gases have been steadily increasing in the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution. Poison ivy is common in woods around the country, making it a bane of hikers, campers, fighters of forest fires, even backyard gardeners. Its itchy, sometimes blistering rash is one of the most widely reported ailments to poison control centers. Compared to poison ivy grown in usual atmospheric conditions, those exposed to the extra-high carbon dioxide grew about three times larger and produced more allergic form of urushiol, scientists from Duke and Harvard University reported. The study appears in this week's Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
U.S. military says a road crash that triggered deadly anti-American rioting in Kabul occurred because a military truck lost its brakes coming down a hill and plowed into a line of cars. Chanting death to America, rioters yesterday stoned the U.S. convoy involved in the accident, then headed to the center of Kabul, ransacking offices of international aid groups and searching for foreigners. The death toll from the unrest rose to 11, most of them from gunshot wounds, and more than 100 people were wounded. Up to 5 people were killed in the accident, but it wasn't clear whether these deaths were among the tolls the hospitals reported. The military says it will compensate the victims or their families. The crash sparked the worst riots across Kabul since the fall of the Taliban in 2001. The rioters claim U.S. troops had shot and killed civilians at the scene of the accident. A spokesman for the U.S.-led coalition confirmed there was gunfire, but said coalition personnel and one military vehicle only fired over the crowd.
The Iraqi High Court reconvened yesterday to hear the testimonies of defense witnesses in the trial against Saddam Hussein. A former Iraqi interior minister claimed the invading U.S. army forced people to testify against Saddam. Mohammed Zaman Abdel Razek Sadoun told the court, U.S. forces have applied pressure on us to testify against President Saddam Hussein. Saddam and 7 of his associates are accused of killing 148 people in the village of Dujail as revenge for an assassination attempt on Saddam by Dujail residents in the summer of 1982. Sadoun said that the compensation was provided to all of Dujail's residents, who had also had their agricultural lands dug up and destroyed in the revenge attack. Sadoun also spoke of recent assassination attempts on former Ba'ath Party leaders. He claimed that Iran was behind the attempted assassination of the former Iraqi vice president in Karbala. The former minister added that his 5-year-old grandson and one of his other grandsons in secondary school were abducted and arrested to force him into handing himself in.
Canada's spy agency said yesterday that some Canadian citizens or residents received training in Al-Qaeda-run camps in Afghanistan. The deputy director of the Canadian Secret Intelligence Service, Jack Hooper, told a Senate committee studying Canada's role in Afghanistan that there are people living in Canada who fought with Al-Qaeda during the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. The Senate Standing Committee on National Security and Defense held a full day of hearings on Canada's military mission in Afghanistan and how it relates to security at home. The hearings come as Canadians and some lawmakers voice growing concern over the deaths of Canadian soldiers serving in Afghanistan as part of a NATO force. Parliament voted earlier this month to extend Canada's mission in Afghanistan until 2009. Canada has about 2,000 soldiers based in Afghanistan, most of them in Kandahar. In outlining the domestic threat, he pointed to examples of people who had lived in Canada who later took part in terrorist attacks. A common thread among them was that time spent at training camps in Afghanistan.
The BBC reports that at least 1,000 troops have deserted the armed forces since the U.S.-led war was launched in Iraq 3 years ago. Britain's defense ministry said, however, it knew of only a handful of deserters since 1989. During 2005 alone, 377 people deserted and are still missing, the British Broadcasting Corporation said on its website, adding that so far this year, another 189 are on the run. Lawmaker John MacDonald told Parliament yesterday that the number of abscondees has trebled since the invasion of Iraq, as he registered opposition to a government bill to sentence deserters to a maximum of life in prison. The BBC cited lawyers who represent troops at courts-martial as saying that growing numbers of soldiers are seeking advice from them about avoiding service in Iraq, even if they want to stop short of deserting. Justin Houston Roberts, who represented Flight Lieutenant Malcolm Kendall Smith, jailed for 8 months for refusing to follow orders over a deployment to Iraq, said, "There has been an increase, a definite upturn." Ben Griffin, a member of the Elite Special Air Service, told his commanding officer this year that he was not prepared to return to Iraq because he said he saw U.S. forces carrying out what he thought were illegal acts.
Defying an official ban and threats of violence, gay and lesbian activists attempted to hold Russia's first gay pride march in Moscow on Saturday. But they were thwarted by police and neo-fascist protesters shouting, "Moscow is not Sodom." Police arrested about 120 people and several gay activists were injured in attacks by religious and xenophobic extremists, this according to the BBC. The key organizer of the event, 28-year-old Nikolai Alexeev, was pulled away by police only moments after the short-lived march began. "This is a great victory, an absolute victory. Look at what's happening," Alexeev shouted as two police officers dragged him into a waiting bus. City authorities had banned the march, which they had called an outrage to society, while religious leaders from all of Russia's major faiths condemned it. It provoked a debate within the gay community over whether the demonstration risked inflaming already widespread homophobia in Russia, but supporters had insisted it was necessary.
Militias fighting for control of the Somali capital, Mogadishu, could face war crimes charges for attempting to prevent the wounded and other civilians from receiving assistance, a UN official warned Monday. The battle between fundamentalist Islamic militias and their secular rivals has forced about 1,500 people to seek treatment at Mogadishu's two main hospitals since the beginning of this year, said Eric LaRoche, the UN humanitarian coordinator for Somalia, in a statement issued in Nairobi. The International Red Cross and armed fighters on Mondays took over one of those hospitals, Mogadishu's Kisaini Hospital, the only facility in the city's northern section providing surgical help to those wounded in the fighting. The International Red Cross says the medical services at Kisaini had been reduced to a minimum. Relatives have removed most patients from the hospital, but 59 still remain, attended by a handful of medical personnel. Somalia has had no effective government since warlords overthrew longtime dictator Mohamed Siad Barre in 1991. They then turned on each other, carving the nation of an estimated 8 million people into rival fiefdoms.
A British-based charity has called for international donors to give specific long-term support to African nations in providing free health care. The charity Save the Children says in a new report that almost 800 children die in Africa daily because they cannot afford to pay for medical treatment. It says greater access to health care services could make a huge difference. It also points out that only limited progress has been made in abolishing health care changes in Africa. Save the Children says the tide of international opinion on health fees is turning. That makes this the right time to help more African governments implement universally free health care and medicine. The ability to afford basic medicines, vaccines, and care is more acute in Africa than other parts of the developing world, the charity says. Africa sees a higher proportion of child deaths from preventable diseases than any other region. Some countries do operate exemption schemes so that high-risk or vulnerable groups, like the very poor, do not have to pay. But in reality, says Save the Children, they are rarely effective. Those who support fees, even partial ones, argue that they are needed to recover costs and that services given free would be overwhelmed. But Save the Children says in many countries, about half of the money raised is lost in administration costs.
Strengthened by his landslide presidential reelection, staunch U.S. ally Alvaro Uribe declared yesterday that he will fulfill his huge responsibility to Colombia. In Colombia's least violent election in more than a decade, Uribe won a second term with 62% of the votes, far outpacing his closest rival. Colombians overwhelmingly returned Uribe to office, the first time for an incumbent in more than a century, because of a surge of economic growth and a decline in crime and violence. Uribe said that foremost among his task will be fulfilling pledges to end the threat from leftist guerrillas and drug traffickers. The victory by the 53-year-old conservative leader came despite a series of election triumphs by leftist candidates in South America, Venezuela, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Argentina, and Uruguay. President Bush called Uribe yesterday morning to congratulate him and to commend the Colombian people for their commitment to democracy. Critics say the president has shown a disinterest in social programs in a country with rampant poverty and fear his reelection will exacerbate what they claim are his autocratic tendencies. Uribe's allies in Washington will judge his second term primarily on his battle against the massive illegal drugs industry, which also funds the illegal groups fighting the civil war. The U.S. Congress has authorized $4 billion in aid to Colombia since 2000, largely for the anti-narcotics strategy.
A NASA satellite mission will be launched this year to study the highest and most mysterious clouds on Earth. Noctilucent, or night-shining clouds, appear as thin bands in twilight skies some 50 miles above the surface. Recent records suggest they have become brighter, more frequent, and are being seen at lower altitudes, or lower latitudes, than usual. Scientists cannot say for sure, but they suspect human activity may be altering the conditions in the mesosphere that drive the cloud's formation. The changes in frequency and brightness have been observed over the last 20 years. Normally confined closer to the poles, they have been seen as low as 50 degrees north. Scientists think most of the dust comes from below, but from above, from space. It is extremely hard for dust in the lower atmosphere to be pulled so high, while meteoritic dust is known to be settling on the planet all the time as rocky space debris falls to Earth. Although the extra carbon dioxide put into the atmosphere by human activity has warmed the air near the Earth's surface, it is thought to have had the opposite effect in the middle and upper atmospheres by radiating heat more effectively into space.
That's the KVU Morning News for Tuesday, May 30th, 2006. Weather for today calls for sunshine with highs in the mid-70s. You're listening to KVOO at 90.7 FM in Portland and Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kvu.fm. Our producer for this morning's newscast is Chris Andre with help from Brian Smith and Kathleen Stevenson. And Matt Dingley is on the boards right now. I'm Becca Bartleson. Stay tuned for...